The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 442, recorded on October 12th, 2016. Welcome to the 442nd edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 275th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Jonah Falcon.
I am TJ Denzer.
I am Scott Durr.
And the VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry. So, first, we have some very sad news. Andy Standing, better known as Redbeard to his community, and also as a contributor, a longtime contributor to Strategy Informer and Game Watcher, he had been missing 2 weeks ago, and they found his body like a week ago, and they did not have a chance to identify it positively until recently. Game Watcher has a eulogy or an epitaph for him, and a lot of people have been posting. I didn't know him personally, but I did really enjoy his video reviews. He had a very nice melodic voice. And the shame of it is that he passed away at age 38. We won't be discussing the circumstances of his death. We'll just be saying he's passed away. TJ, you still write for Game Watcher. Do you know Andy?
No, Andy was before my time.
Oh, okay. But if you look at most of the video reviews he's done, you can see a lot of his work, and you know he had that voice that was made for doing computer game reviews, sort of smooth and I wouldn't say too laid back, but enough that it seemed like he was communicating what he meant, and not just laying back and just talking.
I'll tell you what, I have serious respect for anyone that can do solo video work, because carrying on an interesting topic by yourself is not easy.
I agree. It really is tough. You have to have that kind of energy and kind of mentality of knowing what to say and how to say it and keeping up a dialogue, and it could be really strenuous.
Go ahead, TJ.
I mean, and just like making you're right. You have to have that voice. There is very few people that have that voice that like holds people's interest when they're doing it by themselves. A lot of people do it in teams, and that's the reason for that, is that it breaks up the monotony. But to be able to carry a persona by yourself is very impressive, and that is very unfortunate. 38 is way too young.
Yeah, I mean the same response that to his death that Jew Wario got, who was Justin Carmichael, who committed suicide, the same shocked reactions from around his community, because he was known as Redbeard, and he did a lot of the I think he did you know what they call Let's Plays. I'm not sure, because I didn't follow him on YouTube, but he had a following there as well. Like I said, it was very shocking to everybody. You know, as I said, 38, and the circumstances of his passing, we will not discuss here. If you really want to find out, you can probably find it online. Just that I'd mention that in passing, because I've written for Strategy Informer and Game Watcher, and TJ currently writes for Game Watcher, so yeah. It affects that site heavily as well. So there's a lot of stuff going on this week, obviously, because guess what? The big video game months are hitting hard right now, and we're having a lot of good stuff, and some stuff I wasn't able to include, which is why we're now changing what have you been playing more to a general what's interested you lately, which includes what you've been playing. And Scott sent me a site, an article about the revival of the CRPG, although I will say, you know, it's only now that people think that it's been revived already. But if you really want to include the major CRPGs as in stuff like Baldur's Gate being revived and, Torment, quote-unquote, being revived, and Bardstell is being revived, too. Didn't even mention that. You know, the guy behind Wasteland 3 and Wasteland 2 is also trying to, is getting the Bardstell back. Not the comedic one from a few years ago. I mean, it's an okay game, but no one really thought it was Bardstell. It was more of a parody of RPGs. You know, and Scott, you can talk about this if you want, because I know that isometric RPGs in particular are your bread and butter.
Yes, I'm very interested in those games, and it was really cool to see this article listing that and talking about the revival of it and how there's more and more isometric RPGs. You know, you got Wasteland 3 coming out now, or being developed on Fig. And we also have Tides of Numera came out, which I also need to play and get into. And, you know, it's really just nice to have this era of gaming back, because there was just really some good, I think it's a good vehicle for storytelling, and just good to see it have a standing, having a fandom again for it, and, you know, just, it's good.
You know, I have to say that you really have to credit BioWare and Obsidian for carrying the torch for a while, because it was BioWare and Obsidian, when they were doing their sequels, mm-hmm. who really... And it wasn't the fact they were doing RPGs. What they were doing story interactive RPGs that would remember what you did. And in the case of Mass Effect and a little bit of Dragon's Age, they would remember what you did in subsequent games, especially Mass Effect, which was... always great in Mass Effect when you had something in Mass Effect 3 that was because of a choice you made in Mass Effect 1. And I'm not talking about the major choices, I mean the minor choices. The littlest things, if you did the save file, it would remember, and that was always cool. You know?
Yeah.
And I just want to say, a lot of these games that are coming up, the story, especially Obsidian, they... are taking that ball and running with it, you know? I mean, we're going to be talking about Wasteland 3 later in the program, but a lot of these CRPGs are taking that thing and saying, you know what, if you did something here, it's going to have effect over there, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, that, I think more games need that. It makes you feel like you're getting rewarded for your time that you have invested in the game. You've had an effect in the world, and they're acknowledging that, yes, you did that, and look, this is what happens because of it, and it, you know, just feels good, I think.
And the thing about RPGs, this can't be stressed enough, is that for a long time, MMOs were dominating, but the one problem with MMOs was that you were not the hero. You were one of thousands and thousands and thousands of heroes, and nothing you did mattered. You know, at least in the CRPG, you were, even if you were playing a specific character like Geralt in The Witcher, you were the most important person in that universe, and everything that you did affected everything else, and there wasn't 20 other Geralts doing things around you, you know. Yeah. Oh, look, we have to defeat that boss again.
It's like that quote from The Incredibles, when everybody is special, nobody will be, and that's exactly how World of Warcraft would feel. I'd go in there and defeat the boss, and it's like, so what, I'm number 50, whatever, you know.
And you can go back in and beat him again, just in case you didn't get the drop you wanted.
Later, right.
On the other hand, you know, that really worked for City of Heroes, because it acknowledged everybody's a hero here for a reason, you know, so that actually, you know, so you may be, with superheroes it actually works that you can be the hero among a lot of other heroes, you know, but in a fantasy setting, no, it doesn't work that way. DJ, you want to throw in?
I think that's why Skyrim has done better than the Elder Scrolls Online. It really just doesn't work.
Well, I mean, I have a friend who's hooked on Elder Scrolls Online, so it does communicate to some people. How about you, TJ? You want to throw in?
I mean, I agree. When I first heard about Elder Scrolls Online, the first thought that occurred to me was, no, the fun of those games is that I like to mold the world around me. If other people were in that and molding it with me, then that wouldn't be as cool.
I always thought of the Elder Scrolls games anyway as a single player MMO. I mean, it was sort of redundant to do it as an ESO, you know. But we will get into multiplayer and single player RPGs later in this episode. Spoiler alert. So, what else have you been doing, Scott?
I've been playing Transistor off of Steam, and it's an interesting cyber game. It's like if you wanted to play Shadowrun as a decker inside of a computer,
Okay.
like the entire game. It's very Matrixy, but it starts off kind of weird because you're just thrown into a situation and they don't really tell you what happened that led you to this moment of that you start the game in, and you have this like. You start the game and you're pulling this sword out of a guy. It looks like a data chip. It looks like.
Wait a minute! Is this fantasy or sci-fi? Is this fantasy or sci-fi?
Sci-fi.
Okay, so a sci-fi sword. Got it.
And so you're pulling this out of the guy, and the sword is talking to you. And historically, talking swords are very bad, but in this case, I guess it's okay.
Okay.
And so
it's not calling yourself the Dragon's Tooth, is it?
Other robots, and it's like it really feels like you're in a computer program, the way it's set up, and you're piecing together things that have happened. And I'm still not quite sure. Apparently, she's a singer, and something went down, and she escaped somehow from something. And I'm on the run and just trying to figure out what's going on. But it's fun gameplay because you get. Do pauses and then you can position your character and do attacks and then you activate the pause and you do a bunch of attacks at once and it helps you get rid of enemies a lot easier.
I absolutely love Transistor.
Oh, okay.
Comes out of Supergiant Games, who are the same ones who did Bastion. Fantastic story, fantastic soundtrack. And the way they did the soundtrack for that game was so damn cool because there's like When you're just actively moving through the world, there's a regular overarching soundtrack that plays, and it's very ambient and very cool. But when you go into that system where you pause everything and you basically plan out your attacks, it changes to a more ambient tone where it's the woman, it's the woman singing, like she's humming the tune, and it's so awesome the way they set that up.
And there's even a button where you can just pause and she'll sing, just start singing with the sword in her hand, and it looks like she's using it like a microphone, and she's kind of humming it. I like that effect, too, and there's a little spotlight that comes down on you.
Yeah, and I love the way they set that up, where you can carry out attacks actively in the world, but then you can also pause the game, and you can carry out, and you can plan a series of attacks, which she'll then do rapidly after you unpause it.
Okay, this is an action RPG then.
Yeah, sort of halfway.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at some screenshots. It's 3 isometric, sort of like Bastion, except with cyberpunk a little bit. Yeah, you know what? Before your description of it, I started thinking about Frozen Synapse, and I wonder if you've ever played that game.
Maybe. I'm not sure.
It's the really cyberpunk game by the guys who did Introversion, I think it was, and they did stuff like Darwinia and Uplink, and what's the recent one they did? Oh, yeah, the Prison Simulator. Prison Simulator. Is it called Prison? No, it's not called Prison Simulator, is it?
I don't know.
So, TJ, did I miss the intro, or is that how it's really supposed to start?
It's a slow burn on a story. It'll okay. open up and it'll tell you what's going on. But it's very much that
Prison Architect.
It's very much that shove you into the fray, all confused and stuff thing, and then it'll start to come together. The one thing I'd say. Is there are kiosks around the world, and you should pay close attention to those, because those are where you're going to get an idea of what's going on.
Okay, I have been going to those.
Right. No, it's Prison Architect, that's what. I'll check it out. I'll check that game out. So you already got a jump on what you wanted, one of the games you've been playing, TJ. Has there been anything else that you've been playing?
I haven't been playing Transistor. That's actually a pretty. That was in 2014. I just happened to know that.
Oh, okay.
I actually still have. They made a dynamic theme for PS4, and I've still got that on there because it's just her humming in the background of this this sort of cyberpunk thing, and it's just so beautiful. I could fall asleep to it. But I went back to Civ 6 because I sort of felt bad for not knowing about the religious victory last time we talked about.
Dun
this.
Dun dun! Oh yeah, there is.
And I got a better idea of it, In Civ 5, you had this thing where if you worked it through the council, you could make your religion the world religion.
Yeah.
They essentially expanded that into a victory condition, where if you can influence a majority of the Sims in the game into following your religion, I think it's like at least half of them.
You mean the diplomatic victory when you have the UN and everybody votes for you?
Uh-huh.
Basically.
Sort of, but in this way, it's you have to make more than half the Sims have to be following your religion majority. Okay.
Yeah, just spread your religion to the various cities. I think that's all you have to do.
You know, that sort of reminds me of when you're leading in culture and everybody's angry that their citizens are wearing blue jeans and watching your movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your CDs. You're buying your CDs and your blue jeans.
Yeah.
That's an old 80s reference.
Yeah. But I continued my campaign with the Skythians, and I won a religious victory, and that was really fun. Awesome. You get a new unit. Like, one of the big things that's changed in Civ 6 is that you still can't stack units, but what you can do is you can put a support unit with a combat unit, and it amplifies what they can do.
Yeah.
Like, siege vehicles, like moving towers, don't attack on their own anymore. Instead, what you do is you put a siege tower with melee units, and those melee units then ignore the city's walls and can attack the garrisoned units directly.
Ooh, cool! Because that's always it was always a pain in Civ 5 to try and attack another city. It's like, oh god, this is so boring. Attack! Yes, attack! Yes, attack! Oh, look, it's finally whittling down. Oh no, we have to wait another turn before I can try again.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I've been hearing from PC Gamer and IGN is that one of the biggest things about Civ 6, and we're going to be discussing that later in the show as well, spoiler, is that it made the middle part less boring. You know, because
yeah,
if you ever play Civ 5, the beginning is exciting, the ending is exciting, the middle is like just hanging around.
I would halfway agree with that. I did hit that stretch of like just sort of waiting for things to happen now. But I think it was due in part to the difficulty. The other Civs, it was on Prince difficulty, and the other Civs got a little too passive for me once I started to gain control.
I'm just saying Civ 6 requires you to pay attention to what everybody's doing, because if I remember correctly, everybody now has their own motivations. Agenda. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they have their agendas that they're trying to work towards.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
And you see one of them is given to you like the moment you meet them. The other one you have to find out by either them hating you or them loving you.
You spy them and you say, "Oh, they're building up an army. We better get ready because they're about to go to war with somebody."
France is really good at finding out those secret agendas.
Nice. They weren't in the preview, but I would love to see.
Yeah.
Other than that, I started a new MOBA, Fractured Space.
The Fractured Butthole, is it?
Not quite. No, this one comes from Edgecase Games.
Yeah, I know.
And Fractured Space is a MOBA where you command spatial warships to take these objectives and try to take over the enemy's base. I like it. I like it a lot. It's
you know, it's a great MOBA that no one ever talks about, and that's Awesome Knots. It's a 2D MOBA, so a lot of people, and it's also very, you know, it's a great parody of 80s cartoons. And no one talks about it, but it's perfectly balanced. I don't know why, and no one ever talks about it.
Mm.
It's strange. I mean, it's available now for $10. There, I made my plug. They can now give me the money for doing it.
Fractured Space is a free-to-play. Of course, you can. There's like 31 ships in the game, and you can buy. You can either earn the currency in game to purchase ships, which it's a lot, and it's almost ridiculously high. But you can also purchase platinum, which is like the premium currency that you can use to buy these ships. Even then, I would say it's not like people often fear play to win scenarios when you see something like this, and I wouldn't say it's like that, because you get about four ships at the beginning of the game, and they're pretty good. they give you an idea of what you're going to see in the game, and they all provide a pretty decent playstyle that you can upgrade.
Speaking of spaceships, are you done? Or is there something else you wanted to talk about the MMOBA?
There was one other thing, and that was that one of the things I really dig about this is that where other games you like get equipment and you can buy, you like go back to your store and buy equipment, or you can set up like these little buffs at the beginning, like on whatever character you have.
Oh, don't tell me you're outfitting your ship.
In this one, you you get crews.
Oh, okay.
You actually collect crew members.
Ooh, is this like a Star Trek simulation? Now you're like on the bridge and your people are doing whatever, or more like FTL?
Basically, you get a 5-man crew, and
okay,
you can use one of. You have to have a captain, and then you can have one of any of the other roles, and they are like navigation officer, comms, and they all have their and tactical.
Wow.
And they all have their specific buffs, but you can and there's more than five particular categories of officer, but you can only have five, so it makes you choose what are you gonna pick to up your stats. Like there's the comms officer that makes it so that you can jump between regions faster and you take less damage while you're doing it, and then there's tactical officers, which are obviously they buff your weapons and lower your cooldowns, and it's just an awesome way of like putting out through this system of making your own style of gameplay.
Yeah, they better watch out, because people who do Star Trek are going to say, oh, wait a minute. This sounds like a good idea for us. I mean, that's the entire point of that PSVR game, isn't it? The Star Trek game in which you're on the bridge or something like
sort of.
Yeah. I mean, but it's not... I mean, I get with this game. It's the MOBA, but instead of buffing your character, you're just stocking your ship with different personnel. So mm-hmm. did you see the hour-long video I sent you from Star Citizen?
I didn't have a chance to look at it yet.
Okay, so they are really upping the ante of this game, because this game, it's stressing the fact that you can, you know, that there's procedural generation on these planets. And flying over this planet, you know, you have realistic mountains and foliage and all that stuff and water, you know, and it seems a lot less cut and pasty than, say, No Man's Sky. It seems like they're going with the, we better do this from plate tectonics sort of thing, right? So you have realistic land. But that wasn't the part that impressed everybody. What happens is you take your ship, you find a distress signal on this planet, you land it at one of the small bases, then you get out, equip your armor and get your gun, and all of a sudden it's an open world first person shooter.
Mm-hmm.
And you're wandering around this landscape, you get in a car or your dune buggy. At some point, these bad guys, you drive over a mine, it blows it up. You're forced to get out of your wrecked buggy, or not a buggy, it's more like the Mako. And, you know, after you kill them all, you run over to one of the things where the distress signal was coming from, and nearby, there's a hover bike. So basically, you're going around and trying to find these rescuees. At one point, it becomes Mad Max Fury Road, because there's this giant dust storm that's approaching. And in the middle of all of this, while you're fighting all these guys, suddenly these reinforcements come on their bikes, and out of the ground comes a gigantic sandworm out of dune and starts wreaking havoc all over the place. And that's where the video ends. And
that's fantastic.
And the thing is, I'm thinking, A, either they bit off way more they can chew, and this is going to take another few years to complete, or B, they're creating a universe, and here's the thing, if it is completely procedurally generated, which I find hard to believe, you know, but then again, thinking, yeah, they could do it. The thing I did not see on the planet was, you know, wildlife. I mean, you heard birds chirping, but you didn't see anything. So... But, on the other hand, neither did that happen in Mass Effect. As a matter of fact, Mass Effect had sandworms, too, with no foliage. And I'm just... You have to watch this video and think, geez, if they can pull this off... Because one of the things I'd really like in a space sim, which Elite Dangerous sort of has, is exploration, right? Mm-hmm. And if they can pull off the procedural generation and make complex planets and interesting things to do on these planets... Then I'm sold. I won't even do the multiplayer thing, or maybe I will, but I'm just saying, I'll just want to go from planet to planet and just friggin' explore. you know? Mm-hmm. And that could be one of my roles, is be a rescue technician, because if all that is that I'm, like, responding to distress calls from people on these planets. And the thing is that even if sounds boring, if I play it in the multiplayer universe, I'm going to have other people competing for those people. So either I join up with them or I fight them, it's like a three-way battle between me, these guys, and the AI. I mean, that's all fantastic. So I have cautious optimism. And Chris Roberts, is it Chris Roberts? It is Chris Roberts, right? I get all these guys confused. He has a track record. You know, he's done Freelancer, he's done Wing Commander, so I know he can do a game. But something of this scale is Peter Molyneux to the max.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm just hoping he can pull it off. You know, so we'll see. I mean, it's looking extremely good and amazing. If you watch the video, your jaw will drop. But, like I said, I didn't back it, so I'm just waiting for the finished product.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I was only thinking about doing Squadron 42, which is basically the single-player-only version of that game, because they split it up into two parts. One is Star Citizen, and the other one Squadron 42. And Squadron 42 is the one that's starring with Mark Hamill and Gary Oldham and all these other... Michael Dorn is in it as well. I'm not sure. Lance Henriksen's in it. Anyway, so I was thinking about just getting the single player, but if the multiplayer features that, yeah, I'll go for both.
Hmm.
You know? So for those of you who want to see this video, I'm gonna embed it. I'll also give a link. Because, like I said, this is the sort of thing in which I'm just hoping it isn't Project Milo. Does everybody remember Project Milo? Talking to this kid. A lot of people said it was the pedophile simulator. I could just people be abusive to this poor kid with Kinect. Shut up, kid. Leave me alone. You're worthless. Parental abuse simulator. Anyways. So, your thoughts on Star Citizen, TJ?
After No Man's Sky, I'm skeptical of anything that promises this much.
Well, I mean, there's been other games that have done what No Man's Sky has done.
Right, but what I'm saying is that I've been hurt before. I'm not gonna buy into it until I see something like probably post-release, because we've seen what trailers can do, what you can do with trailers, and then you put out a game that's not that.
Yeah. Unrelated news, and you can comment on this. I can't believe I forgot it. Oh, Tim Schafer. Tim Schafer released a new video of Psychonauts 2. And basically it was in the same place. It was at Whispering Rock. And, you know, it's not going to take place in Whispering Rock. They were doing it as a... and they showed how much the graphics have been upped. And some of Raz's new powers, like being able to create multiple versions of himself, and psychic knives that he can throw. I also learned that you can still invest in it. $500 up to $3,000. And that's gotten me... I've invested $800 in the first place with backing this freaking game. And I'm wondering if I should back it for $500 or $1,000 just to see if I can make my money back. So, you saw the video.
That was really interesting to see the battle mechanics that they're working on. And I also like that they're trying to make more complex puzzles with the cloning and some of the other stuff, probably. So that looks pretty good. It looks like a promising game.
Well, like I said, I just hope they don't ramp up the difficulty like they did with the first game. Now, you said you didn't complete it yet. How far did you get, Scott?
I think... I was finishing the Disco Ladies.
Oh, okay, Mila.
Well, I found that kind of hard.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you find her hard, just wait until the last two missions or so with the bunny and also the meat circus. I'm wondering if in Mila you went into her secret room. Okay. If you do Mila again, there's one part of that level that is pure nightmare fuel, and you'll find out what her secret her worst memory was.
Yeah, I remember her worst nightmare. It was all the children burning in the orphanage. Right.
Yeah, and the worst part is, since she's a psychic, she could hear them dying from a mm-hmm. while away, you know.
Still hears their screams, I know.
In her brain, yeah. I mean, that was pretty sad, and a lot of people were scared of that. I just found it sad. But it does explain a lot about her bubbly, upbeat personality, mm-hmm. you know. Did you do Sasha Nines?
Yes, okay. I did his.
Yeah, that's hilarious. It ramps up the difficulty. It starts getting difficult when you deal with the brain tanks. Oh, did you do Kochamara in Gagalore?
See, the coach I think I did do.
That did you do Gagalore? In which you become a Godzilla. It's that Gagalore! No? Oh, that's hilarious. You got to try that one. No. The first coach thing is just your basic braining.
Yeah.
There's another one when you actually go into coach's head. So Psychonauts 2. And I also got the review code for the Xbox One version of Roos, which is a PC game. I'm pretty sure TJ's familiar with it. And it's basically a god game in which you control four different types of gods or things. You know, fire, water, air, and earth. And you basically change the land. It's on a small planet that rotates as you go around it. So I'm basically starting that game. Roos, I think, came out in like 2013, maybe. It's finally coming on console.
I hadn't seen this before, but I'm looking at screenshots right now, and it looks gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was on PC for a while, so I'm finally going to play it on console. And, you know, one little complaint I have is that the tutorial interferes too much with your thing, so I couldn't exactly do stuff like, because it tells you, oh, press Y to check the stats. But while the tooltips box is up for during things, you can't do it. So it's a lot of, oh, I have to remember to do that and check out what it is. But, again, there's a lot of subtlety to it that may not be readily apparent, even in the beginning. Like, if you build water, and then you build fertile land. If you build mountains a little bit off from the water, the fertile land away from the water becomes desert, which is basically why, if you ever know the United States, that's what the Rocky Mountains does, is it turns part of the thing, into, depending on which side the prevailing winds are, into a desert. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you learn some stuff, and you have to make a planet that's a mix of desert and forest and all this stuff, and then you have to bequeath food and stuff on the people, but at some point they become warlike, and then you have to put them down.
Punch cities.
You can punch a city, yeah.
I'm looking at that, and I just think, wow, I want to see what it looks like after that.
Yeah, it should be like something like $5 or $9 on Steam by now if you want to play it on PC. But like I said, it was a good B plus games from the reviews that it's had. So, I mean, if you like God games, I mean, they're shockingly very few of them. You know, this is one of the few that's been released. This is a pretty good God game. I still have Goddess, which is Peter Molyneux's God game. I haven't gotten back into it. Oh, and there's also, I still have Stonehearth. And Stonehearth is another God game, but it's still in beta. So there were some updates that sounded interesting. I might try that later when I get a chance, but right now I'm just going to do Roos, you know, and see how that is. I mean, I want to see what the fuss is about. And so far I'm enjoying it. Other than that, you know, I got a thing. I got the release date for the next episode of Batman, the Telltale series. I forgot what it is, and we're not going to get into it because it's not important right now. Other than that, you know, we're going to move on to the news. Go ahead, TJ.
Okay. Wasteland 3 multiplayer details revealed in the new Fig update from PC Gamer. One of the big new features in Exile's recently announced RPG Wasteland 3 is cooperative multiplayer, which the studio said will give two players the ability to work together or separately to bring the Ranger experience to Colorado, and perhaps put the screws to one another when their backs are turned. How that system works is detailed in the latest FIG update, in which game director Chris Keenan says multiplayer is designed to be a natural extension of the single-player campaign. Multiplayer-specific campaigns will be tied to you and whatever your whichever of your friends you talk into joining up. And that's the gun.
Yeah, talked into, you know, it's like, oh, you want to play this game with me? I'm just going to... And watch me screw you to the wall. Actually, you know what? I'm pretty sure that the three of us are going to have to be linked in Wasteland 3 just to see what happens.
You won't be able to swap them out with someone else. You won't be able to swap them out with someone else, so you better like that person.
Well, I think they mean by the save game, though. I mean, that particular save is going to be... I'm pretty sure you can create a new save with someone else.
But each player will run an independent squad assembled from a shared pool of Rangers who can be transferred between squads but not used by both simultaneously.
I can just see it now. Oh, come on! You took Carter? I needed a Carter for my mission! What the hell? Oh, that's it. You know, next time I'm going to take Doug and you're not going to be able to use him forever. You know, this is going to have all this negotiations between who can take who.
That also sort of reminds me of Mass Effect 2, in which you put whoever you put in that suicide mission on particular tasks like Squad B is somebody that you don't get to take with you when you're going through the Reaper base.
You know, in Mass Effect 3 and the Citadel DLC, the person who you were with the most will say, are you going to take me? Because you always take me. And the person who always uses them the least says, I know you're not going to take me because you never take me. If you've done the Mass Effect 3 Citadel DLC, because they actually acknowledge who you use the most and who you use the least.
Well, let's see here. The squads can travel and fight together, or they can split up and work independently, which in Exile could have important consequences for all involved. Quote, for example, you made a deal with a criminal gang of smugglers, turning a blind eye and helping keep their trade routes clear from danger for a cut of their profits. In single player, this would mean you receive a payment from time to time at your Ranger base for keeping the deal going, Keenan explained. In multiplayer, because both you and your friend are playing independently, it would be possible for one player's party to make the deal with the smugglers and not tell the other player. And thus that player would receive compensation in return. Meanwhile, the second player might independently choose to attack the smugglers for the good of the people of Colorado, not knowing of the prior deal, and that would lead to a similar consequence where the smugglers end up at Ranger HQ asking hard questions. How that situation is ultimately resolved will also have consequences for both players, even if only one of them is involved in handling it. Players will sometimes be required to be together for key narrative moments and missions, which Keenan said will happen infrequently and only at core moments of the game. And if either of you can't, or maybe just don't want to, continue playing for some reason, say because your fellow Ranger boss can't go for 5 minutes without making an enemy or getting somebody killed, it will be possible to convert the game to a single-player campaign. The update also notes that the first FIG stretch goal, 37 pieces of flare, has been unlocked. More Ranger team missions have been added, and the free copies of Stasis and Underrail that were offered during the first 48 hours of crowdfunding are now available on GOG as well as Steam. The Wasteland 3 FIG campaign has so far raised a little over $2.9 million and will continue to run until November 3rd. Nifty. I loved Stasis.
And, oh, I have Stasis. Yeah. I haven't played it yet.
So it's an isometric Soma, if you're aware.
I just haven't had time to play it. So, Scott, you toss in since you've been silent during the entire time.
Yeah, I really love this update. I like this idea of co-playing and maybe screwing each other over or getting underhanded. I mean, sounds like a lot of freaking fun. I've been dying, actually.
Oh, wait a minute.
An isometric RPG with somebody else, and this sounds like it would be even more fun.
Oh, wait,
so if TJ gets this game, we could play it, TJ.
Yeah, oh, wait, you know, Scott is talking awful light, like he's just getting ready to grief people, doesn't he? He just sounds like he's just getting ready. Oh, yeah, this is what I've been waiting for. a chance to grief someone else in the same game.
No, not so much griefing, but just that this is more incentive to, you know, get people to play with me on these games, because like I have Baldur's Gate and Icewind Dale and nobody to play with.
Lonely experience, so, huh?
You know what's awesome about this is that it builds communication between the person that you're going to play with. You like not just in the game, or just like it makes you have to, once you're done playing your segment, go chat that person up on Skype and just leave them notes about what you did so that you guys are on the same page, or else something will go wrong.
You could talk over TeamSpeak or you know, or Skype even, and coordinate that way too. Like, oh, I'm in this place and I'm coming down that way, I'll be there and whatever. It's almost like you would actually be more into the game, because you'd be coordinating your forces, and that, oh my god, that would be so awesome.
You know the best part of Star Wars: The Old Republic, the MMO. The best part of that game was doing multiplayer conversations, and this game seems to get it. You know, although I'm pretty sure if you're doing the same mission with someone else, you'll have that option of having a multiplayer conversation. But I'm just saying, there's that interactivity when you're doing a multiplayer conversation in Star Wars: The Old Republic. I wish they had more of, you know, because it made you feel like you're more part of a team. This makes it seem like you're more part of a team, because for those of you who played the original Wasteland, you could split up your team as much as you wanted to, right? So you had your team over here and your team, the other team over here. This is just an extension of that, except now it's an entire player over here and an entire player over here. You know, so.
Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like, we talk about, that team aspect of, oh, God, you always take her. Why do you always take her? Why don't you leave her for me once in a while? But also, there's that idea of you could coordinate with someone in the way of, like, hey, man, I'm going into an area, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to need something like an engineer. Leave me this guy, or at least leave me this other guy. Don't take him both.
Or better yet, help me out here. Come on, dude. I'm sorry. I'm doing my mission here. I can't help you. Wait. I need to do this mission, though. I know I'm going to get team wiped if I don't have some help. You know, that sort of thing.
I could see moments like there's a lot of moments in the video game sometimes where it looks like you're about to lose and then somebody comes in. Imagine that on a multiplayer level where you're having difficulty and your buddy just comes in at the last minute, and it's like, that's not even scripted, and it just, that would be so awesome.
You know, the thing to make this really work, though, is you have to have permadeath for these characters then. If you have multiplayer. I'm just saying, because it wouldn't work if they would just be resurrectable, you know? If your friend screws up and gets one of your favorite people killed,
these guys,
you know,
they have the same mentality as Pillars of Eternity does. It's very hard to heal yourself. If you get, like, a bullet wound, you're going to be carrying that for a while. You know, it's not going to just, you're not going to cast Cure Light and be okay. You know, it's, if your guy goes down, you've got to go replace him at the ranger station.
Well, you know, I mean, Brian Fargo and Chris Avalon, you know, I mean, when they were doing, I think it was Pillars of Eternity, or one of the games, you got a free copy of Wasteland 2 with it, you know, or something like that, you know, which you got to, you know, sort of like interconnecting, or at least they were saying, oh, by the way, Wasteland 2 is starting up their thing. Oh, and Shadowrun is starting up their thing.
They're supporting each other, yes.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? I see here, it's cool that you can, like, if it's not working out with someone, you can convert your game into a single-player campaign. I am, however, curious if they will make it go the other way as well, where
you'll be
able to convert it into, like, I don't see why it wouldn't be able to, though. Like,
no, because then you could too easily cheat. See, that's the problem. You have a cheating problem there. You know, so it seems like if you're going to go to single player, that's your last draw. That's your version of rage quitting.
We'll have to see.
But like I said, you know, now they have to explain vehicles next. That's probably going to be the next update.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest things I'm concerned about. Like, it's just, in an isometric turn-based game, I guess this isn't turn-based. Is this turn-based?
I don't know, but, you know, it sort of tells you what kind of scale the game's going to be.
Right.
I think it's quasi-turn-based in that you can move around until combat happens.
Yeah.
And then you have turn-based.
Mm. And in that case, like, do they just use the vehicles to travel, or do they get out of the vehicles when a fight happens, or what? Like,
I would imagine that it's still free moving for whoever's, you know, not in combat. You know, which would actually make it useful if you drove to where someone's having combat, and then you get into combat because they're in combat. You know, sort of.
Imagine that you're using the vehicles in combat. Otherwise, what's the point? Because I was kind of under the impression that my Gap Rangers were using vehicles in Wasteland
2. Well, it's time, though. It's time.
Actively using them.
Here's the thing. If you have two separate players, one's on foot, the other's in a car, you know, one's going to get to a location faster than the other person. I think that's entirely the point. You know, it's basically speed. Also, when you're in a car, you have extra armor if someone does attack you.
That's true.
You know? Or you could, here's the thing. If you could have a car, you might as well have car weapons. So, you know, you have some character on the back with a mounted machine gun or something like that, you know, in a pickup truck. I mean, I'm pretty sure they're going to have that thing. Which reminds me, you know, I really want Car Wars to come back. I mean, Auto Duel is still one of my favorite games to play. It's a dream. Anyways, go ahead. So,
it would be hilarious if you could set up a situation where one of your teams gets caught in combat and you can actually have that. Like, go on and complete the mission!
Or it's sort of like, what are you guys saying? It's a bug hunt, man! It's a bug hunt! I can't make it! I need your help! I can't! I'm over here! We're fighting giant spiders! No, we're here! We're fighting insurrectionists! You're both screwed at the same time. You're both screwed at the same time. You can't help each other, and all you can do is listen to the other team die through your walkie-talkie. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. Civilization VI offers multiple leaders for each civilization. This comes to us from Shack News. Previous games in the Civilization franchise didn't allow for your civilization to be led by more than one leader. This is about to change with Civilization VI with the addition of Gorgo, another leader for Greece. Pericles was already known to be the leader of Greece, but Gorgo wasn't.
Civ 4, you could have multiple leaders.
Not at the same time. Not at the same time, though. That's what they're saying here. I know you could have multiple players and multiple leaders, because in Civ 4, I think it was what? George Washington and Abraham Lincoln was on your thing? No. Yeah.
And it was George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt.
Oh no, that Franklin Roosevelt was a late addition. That was bonus. I remember those. But the thing is that each of them had different powers. Each of them had different powers. But Gorgo will have a different style of play in the game as compared to Pericles. She will also have. Hold on, time for soda. She'll also have her own special attack ability called Thermopylae, which gives Greece a culture boost every time an enemy is vanquished in battle. You'll also receive half the defeated enemy's base strength. Anytime you get a strength bonus, that's a win for strategy games. If there wasn't a reason to decide between leaders, Civilization VI wouldn't even have them in the game. As mentioned, Gorgo and Pericles have different abilities, but they also have different styles of play, playing in the same at the same time. If you saw the new Greece video, it's also important to note that each leader will have different locations their unit will have access to during gameplay. It'll be interesting to see how different each leader is when Civilization VI launches on October 21st.
So if I'm to understand this correctly, you could have one player playing Gorgo of Greece in one civilization of the map, and then another person could be playing Pericles of Greece in another civilization of the map in the same game.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
The interesting thing is that, it's not interesting, but it's of note, there's going to be a turn cast on the 22nd, the day after, in which you're going to have a multiplayer, everybody's going to be playing in multiplayer, and I'm wondering if people are going to have the same Civ, but different leaders.
At least for now, it's just Greece that'll have different leaders.
I'm pretty sure, you can bet that it's going to be extended to other Civs, though.
Oh, yeah. But probably during the DLC or whatever. Yeah, one of the DLCs.
For example, America is who again? No, it's America is Theodore Roosevelt. And I'm willing to bet you they're gonna have someone offbeat, because Theodore Roosevelt is someone you really think about. Oh, it'd be hilarious if they had FDR as the other one. See, if Theodore
FDR was in Civ 4.
I know. I'm just saying it'd be hilarious if you have the both relatives in the same game. No, but Maybe Thomas Jefferson. I don't think he's been used as a U.S. leader yet. No, or has he? No, he hasn't. No. So maybe, you know. So it'll be interesting because, you know, then you won't have this fight over two people, you know, oh, I wanted Rome, but you want it, I want Rome, you know, so you don't have people fighting over the... At least you'll have... You can have Rome with Julius Caesar. You can have Rome with Octavius.
You could still probably select the same civ. You'll just be a different color.
I'm just saying, but you'll have a different leader each.
China are you, you know? Or Inca or whatever.
And it makes sense for Greece because Greece is basically Athens and Sparta, and Gorgo is the leader of Sparta.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense in that way, too. So
I guess in that game, Sparta is a civ.
Yeah, but Sparta's not going to be a civ. It's going to be a faction of Greece.
Yep.
So, oh, wait, you know, if that's the case, then maybe it'll be Robert E. Lee as a U.S. leader. Ooh.
Uh-oh.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, it definitely won't be Jefferson Davis. That'll be no. Anyways, so it's an interesting twist on the thing. So, yeah, Civ, I already made my pre-order. I did the digital deluxe because, you know, why not? At least get... I don't want to have to buy all the DLC, or at least I don't want to have to... I want it to automatically upload, you know?
Yeah.
So, day after it's released, we'll be doing a massive Turncast. Plug. For the Turncast.
Yeah, so it's going to be a all-day event that we're doing, like a marathon.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to start with some of our Civ players in Europe starting up first, and then as the time goes on, everybody else is, activates, will be on, and especially during our usual Turncast time, that's probably when the bulk of us will get on and we'll play, and I think we're going to try to stream the gameplay, and maybe somebody might do some recording. Or I'm not sure how that part works, really.
Did you capture me becoming a warmonger when I decided that the Mongols must die?
Yeah, okay. Dan reported you.
I'm pretty sure people probably remember me most for that, in which the Mongols took my
They remember your quote that they're the lawn and you're the lawnmower man.
You know, no, I'm just saying they took my settler, and that was the last straw. They took my settler. Oh, by the way, someone, I forgot who, posted a 4.5-hour Civ 6 video of an entire game. I didn't watch it, but apparently one of their settlers were captured, and it took them 4,500 years to get him back.
Wow.
So it's like his captured settler was there, but they were held hostage for a couple of millennia. I'm pretty sure that could happen in a game. It's just really funny, you know.
Okay.
So yeah, and of course TJ's been you're playing with a finished build or a preview build. Have you gotten your final build yet?
I haven't gotten the final build yet. I've been playing with a preview build.
Are you even getting a review build?
I don't know yet.
Yeah, okay. Otherwise, you'll just have to spend money just like the rest of us.
No!
I mean, I could have asked Dennis Shirk for a copy, but I said, nah, I don't need to. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, Scott.
Okay. Hold on. Let's see, where is it?
Back to Turok.
Turok 2 remake is coming according to Night Dive Studios. This is from Shack News. A representative from Night Dive Studios posted on Steam that a remake of the N64 classic Turok 2 is coming, but rights to the Turok license have put a crimp in the productive via PC Gamer. So as many of you may have guessed, working on the rights to these classic titles can be tricky, and sometimes contractual obligations prevents the transparency we've enjoyed on some of our titles, which is why updates have been mysteriously absent, wrote a Night Dive developer. The publisher posted an update to put Turok fans at ease. A remake of the first game launches on Steam last year, followed by nearly 10 months of silence regarding a remake of Turok 2. We're well aware of the demand for Turok 2, and it is still in development, he wrote. In fact, we started development just shortly after the launch of the first Turok.
Turok 2 is a bigger game with more enemies, more weapons, more locations, and most importantly, Turok 2 had multiplayer. Turok 2 Seeds of Evil was released on Nintendo 64 in October 1998, 16 years ago this month. It garnered acclaim from critics and players for unique weapons, local multiplayer, a staple in console FPS following Rare's success with GoldenEye 007 8 years earlier, and varied gameplay. Turok 2 went to sell over 1 million copies, a high mark for the late 1990s. Night Dive is well aware of the nostalgia surrounding the N64 classic, which is why they're not rushing the remaster. In our quest to bring you the most authentic experience of the highest quality level available, we've decided to give Turok 2 the love it deserves and release the game when it's done, which is why we've all been able to say this, Turok 2 is coming. Thank you for your continued support and patience. We know you're going to love it. See, I like that attitude. When it's done, you know, not rushing it. And I admit Turok 2 wasn't my favorite of games, but I always liked that it was a dinosaur fighting game. You ride dinosaurs and fight them and whatnot. That was cool. And
I wonder who the rights were, though.
They're taking their time with this. That's always good.
Yeah, I wonder who the rights hold up is. Is it with Dark Horse Comics, or is it with Acclaim? Or Acclaim doesn't exist anymore. Whoever owns the rights to the video game, I wonder.
It's not Nintendo, that's for sure.
I think... I'm going to go on a limb here, but
Ubisoft?
I think it might... Because 2008 was published, the 2008 Turok that sucked. Yeah. Well, it didn't suck, but it wasn't great. It was published by Touchstone Games and Disney Interactive, so I wonder if they have part of the license for this.
Huh.
Which if Disney has the license, then I can understand why it's hard to get through this.
Yeah, I mean, if the thing about Night Dive, by the way, for the folks out there, is that they are actually responsible for a lot of the remakes that we've been seeing, you know? They're responsible for the System Shock reboost. They were behind the re-release of I Have No Mouth But I Must Scream. They remastered Wizardry 6, 7, and 8. They remastered The Seventh Guest and The 11th Hour. They wanted to do No One Lives Forever, but the rights licensing on that is confusing as hell, and no one knows exactly who owns it, because there are three companies with a stake in the game, you know, Activision, 20th Century Fox, and Warner Brothers. So yeah, I mean, they're behind a lot of this nostalgia stuff. I mean, did they do they didn't do the Baldur's Gate, that was someone else, but they have been doing a lot of the other stuff, you know, like the Looking Glass Studios stuff. So
I'm reading, so when the Dark Horse comics of Turok were made, they were licensed by Classic Media, which is owned by DreamWorks. So, I don't know. It's a web. It's a web of intrigue. But yeah, Night Dive Studio. Night Dive are the ones that are making the newest.
Yeah, System Shock 3. Shock. Yeah.
Okay, they're making System Shock 3. Are they the ones that are also remaking the original?
Yes, they're doing System Shock 1 as well.
They remastered it, and they remastered System Shock 2.
Yeah.
But they're also making a completely new build of the first game.
Yes.
Yeah, Night Dive Studios is awesome. They are busy as hell, too.
They're fans. I mean, they also redid all the Tex Murphy games, too. They redid all the Tex Murphy games. I don't know if they did the new the Tex Murphy game that was on Kickstarter, but I know they're remaking a lot of stuff. I mean, they just remade Star-Lord and Necropolis and Time-Lapse and Terra Nova. You know, a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of this stuff, you know, a lot of these aren't exactly hard because, you know, they're really old and all I have to do is just reboot it, but a lot of these things, you know, they're putting a lot of love into. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, there's a lot of people who never got to play Seventh Guest, and guess what? They got to play it, you know. They also did what's called some of Sid Meier's games, like Pirate's Gold and Colonization.
Hmm.
So, the original Colonization. I know there was a new... you know, I prefer the old colonization to the new colonization, to be frank. Anyway, do you ever play the Wizardry games, either of you?
I did.
Yeah.
Those were fun.
Yeah, so.
I think, I don't know, I'm not too into the whole first-person grid-like movement. I again, trying not to... I like that free form of the being able to walk around anywhere and that...
Why, you didn't like the original Might and Magic games? Come on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I
Bard's Tale.
Them, but it's just, they weren't my preferred favorite.
I know, you like 2D. Got it. You know, back in the day, you didn't have the option of 2D isometric. It was either top-down or step-based first-person like Dungeon Master.
Right.
I've never done games where you can't really see your character. The portraits don't really do it for me.
Oh!
Right.
Oh, come on. The Gold Box games are awesome.
They were. Those were fun.
I don't know. I just like seeing more than my character's pretty little face.
Well, actually, you could see your character in the Gold Box games just as a bunch of sprites, but you got to customize the sprites.
I would love the Silver Swords to be remade, because you got to fight a lech in that game, and I haven't fought a lech in, like, forever, you know?
Well, you get to fight Donald Trump, who's a big lech.
Oh,
you mean a lich. I'm wondering if they did remake the... No, they just re-released them. The Gold Box games.
Oh, yeah.
And it was on GOG, yeah. Yeah.
Yes, I bought them.
You know, the one game they haven't re-released, though, is Spelljammer. And even though it's average, it's very rare that you get to see the Spelljammer license on anything.
Yeah, it just never did that well. And it's a shame, too, because I really love the concept and the idea of a medieval fantasy and you're in space.
Right.
Come on.
You know, I may get the Gold Box classics from GOG because I just want to replay them and see, you know, just to play Pool of Radiance again and all that stuff.
Pool of Radiance.
You know, I'm going to say this right now. I liked Hellspar, damn it.
You can like it.
I don't know why I get so much shit from people. Just because there's a part in which you're riding a horse, you have to jump over things as you go along. Is there something wrong with that?
I don't know, I guess.
I owned all these games because I did get Ultima 9. Did it come with Ultima 9? No, it came with something. Oh, no, it was a big pack that was released by Activision at one point. Because they released all of it themselves. And I had Mental Barazin, but I couldn't run it for whatever reason. I don't know. It was at the time in which it was pre-DOSBox, you know, so I couldn't play it. So, I don't know. Did they release the Unlimited Adventures? Because I loved that. Unlimited Adventures, for those who don't know, was the make-your-own Gold Box game, which was great.
That was cool.
I also loved Adventure Construction Set, which was far less sophisticated, but I still loved it.
Oh, and you get the original Stronghold, too.
Oh, yeah, I have Stronghold, though. Hmm. And Stronghold was one of those games, when I was playing it on my 64, it was so cool, even though I died fairly quickly. That was a tough game.
Simulator, that was a cool game. Yep, and Unlimited Adventures is one of them, and there's Al-Kadim.
Did it have Fantasy Empires with it?
There's a whole bunch.
They have Fantasy Empires with it? Because Fantasy Empires I liked as well. It was a war game, sort of, kind of. And you sent your heroes off into missions. They either came back dead, or they came back with a new magic item. And then when you went to war, they would be on the field and attacking things. If you chose to, you could take control of them and start having them whack orcs left and right, you know, in a massive battlefield. So
that's cool.
Yeah, and it boasted the first quote-unquote interactive DM.
That sounds like Ogre Battle a little bit, too, where you had your military units going across the map. And you're
there was that Sierra game. Places. Yeah, I think you're talking about that Sierra game.
It wasn't Sierra.
No, but there was a Sierra game, AD&D game, and I'm looking it up right now. Hold on. It was Birthright. Birthright, the Gorgon's Alliance. But the thing about that was they found a way to cheat in it, in which they found a way in which you can teleport yourself right to the Gorgon, kill him while it was still low level, and that was it. Game over. You win after two rounds. But I never did that because it was sort of like defeating the entire purpose of the damn game. But you know what? If you want to try Birthright, it's actually pretty fun. There is a Windows 95 version, so it is. I'm pretty sure you could get it to be backwards compatible. But yeah, Birthright was fun. It was very cinematic, sort of, kind of. It had a wonderful map, let me put it that way. And use a Doom 2 engine. Nice. Anyway, try Birthright, Gorgon's Alliance. It was one of the few Sierra Online AD&D games. So, anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, TJ.
Nintendo wanted to buy the rights to Harry Potter in the 1990s, from Business Insider. Back when the first Harry Potter book blew up and everyone wanted a piece of that pie, there was a mad clash to buy the rights to it to turn it into video games, movies, and more. Warner Brothers won that battle and turned Harry Potter into what we know it as today. One unlikely company that was in contention, though, was Nintendo. Yes, the family-friendly video game giant wanted exclusive rights to make Harry Potter video games in perpetuity. This was dug up by Unseen64 last year in an interview with some anonymous employees who gave us precious few details about the arrangement. Two small teams at Nintendo worked on concepts for a third-person adventure game and a Quidditch game to pitch to J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter series. Nintendo's plan was to acquire the rights and produce adaptations of each future book in the series that would coincide with each book's release. According to Unseen64, there was an internal conflict at Nintendo over how the characters should look. Artists initially wanted them to resemble the first book's cover, but the higher-ups at Nintendo demanded a more Japanese manga-inspired look. That would have been weird. this was, of course, before the movies existed, and we all had an easy mental image for how each character looked. Unseen64 could not publicly share Nintendo's character concept art. Unfortunately for Nintendo, J.K. Rowling was looking to sell the rights to a company with far greater resources, one that could bring her a world to multiple forms of media and not just video games. Warner Brothers obviously fit that bill much better than Nintendo ever could. Had this deal somehow miraculously gone through, the Harry Potter film series may not have happened at all. One has to wonder what Nintendo's vision of J.K. Rowling's masterpiece would have been like.
By the way, they did have one piece of character of art, which showed Hogwarts as a castle on top of a really tall mountain, you know. So that, you know, that is sort of a hint of what it might have been like. So yeah, Nintendo Harry Potter.
I don't think they would have been able to, like they said, they would not have been able to carry it the way Warner Brothers did and push it. And I'm not sure how good those games would have been.
And you know who's really glad this didn't happen? Daniel Radcliffe. Because yeah. had they went to a manga inspired look, yeah, Daniel Radcliffe's not getting cast. As a matter of fact, there's a good chance there wouldn't even be a live action version anyway.
I'll tell you what manga Harry Potter probably would have looked like. Go look up Kiki's Delivery Service, look up Tombo, and then put a little electric scar on his forehead.
Yeah, I know exactly who you're talking about.
But hey, you know, I mean, movies based on Nintendo properties have all done well, right? Super Mario Brothers, The Wizard, because, you know, well, I love the Power Glove.
For Nintendo products.
I love the Power Glove. It's so bad.
It is bad. I think it would have been very different, and like they said, it's a good chance that the movies probably wouldn't have happened. And I think it's kind of unusual or just odd that they insisted on a manga look for the characters, because you know, there's a lot of Japanese art that doesn't really look very manga, I guess. I don't know.
Well, this is the 1990s, so Nintendo does what Nintendo wants to do. Mm-hmm. You know?
Nintendo's still doing what Nintendo wants to do.
Yeah, but then they had that was the height of their power, when they could enforce the Nintendo seal of quality on things, which is basically their way of saying, give us money or we're not gonna back your game.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyways, we don't have any letters this week, but look for our show notes at gamingpodcast.net, along with industry news and your gaming history articles. We enjoy your feedback, so leave us comments at our blog at gamingpodcast.net. Also, hit us up at facebook.com/gamingpodcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave some iTunes comments. I am at Jonah Falcon.
I am at Johnny Chugs.
And I am at Alpha Shard.
So we will see you next week, and I'm just trying to think of I'm now seeing Harry Potter as a 16-bit character, you know, sort of looking a little bit like Alex in Wonderland. Anyways, what? Go ahead.
Oh, it's just I was thinking of various characters that would have looked like Harry Potter, and you know, big round glasses and a little scar on the forehead. And it would have been different. Definitely.
And he would have been, at this point, he would have been a minor character in Super Smash Brothers.
Yeah.
You know. Oh, look, we have to play Harry Potter from those stupid Harry Potter games. Watch him get shot by Solid Snake.
Yeah, I don't think the games did, the actual Harry Potter games did that well, though.
Some of them did. As a matter of fact, you know, the Kinect Harry Potter game was one of the few that actually worked.
Oh.
You know, I mean, but, yeah, I mean, there were some games that were good, and there were some games that were just terrible, and some, I mean, Lego Harry Potter, let's leave it at that.
Okay, the Lego ones were probably good.
Yeah. Anyways, we will see you next week.
Happy gaming, everyone.
Take care.
And that's it. See you later.